On my way to Tasmania at the start of this year, I read Siddhartha on the endless flight from Toronto to Sydney. Hermann Hesse's book is 100 years old, give or take. I think it's 102 years old. And it's the story of the eponymous hero seeking what matters, seeking a well-lived life. Now, midlife, middle of the book, he's called away from his spiritual path to be in the world. Love and money, ambition and status, he gains it all. Now, at first, he manages to hold it lightly, but in time, he loses his sense of himself. He has all the trappings. He's got gold and he's got silk. But you can see, you can feel it's an empty life. And there's a moment where Siddhartha suddenly sees that emptiness. He feels it in his bones. And in that moment, he wrestles with that existential question. Do I stay or do I leave and continue the journey? Do I stay or do I leave and continue the journey? So spoiler alert, Siddhartha leaves and he does go and find a new way of being. But if we are all, in our own ways, Siddhartha, we all get to some moment, some variation of that Siddhartha moment. We're at the peak of something. And we realize that this is not the culmination of it all, but a crossroads, a time when a new adventure awaits, if we have the courage to answer the call. We add on, we accumulate, and then we have the opportunity to once again shed, to get back to what matters most, to what is essential. We travel out so we can return back home. Welcome to Two Pages with MBS, the podcast where brilliant people read the best two pages from a favorite book, a book that has moved them, a book that has shaped them. Amy Elizabeth Fox is co-founder and CEO of Mobius Executive Leadership. Now, I know quite a lot of leadership firms, and most of them honestly leave me pretty cold, pretty underwhelmed. But what I admire about Mobius is its deeper commitment to transformation. And with that comes a subtle understanding of the deeper rhythms of change required for transformation. It's not typical in the leadership space. And no doubt Mobius's uniqueness comes in part from Amy's sense of herself. She is very much not some shallow leadership expert.
Social entrepreneur and mystic, maybe, is a good answer.
A social entrepreneur and mystic.
I'm also a spiritual seeker for many, many years and very interested in the inner life and mystical reality and the sense of the real enchantment of life and in everyday life.
So for leaders, capital L leaders, people who talk about OKRs and KPIs and strategy and market share, what's the work Amy and her colleagues could possibly do?
One way to think about my path, my work, my life's purpose is helping very senior leaders who have influence over cultural architecture to come home to themselves in a deep way, to reopen their heart, and to care about the quality and nature of the world in a really profound way.
Coming home to yourself, caring about the quality and nature of the world, that's the journey. Amy has her own story of transformation. As a child of liberal activist parents, she was already set on the path to social inclusion and justice. So her transformation, her growth, wasn't a radical change in her beliefs. But a challenge with her health led to a deeper understanding of her work. Her sense of self became intensified and clarified.
In my early 20s, I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and the prognosis for that disease, thankfully, even then was very good. I wasn't really in danger of dying, but the chemotherapy treatment was very aggressive. So I got quite sick and frail in the course of the treatment. Mm. And I can remember sort of the successive CAT scans that you would go through to see how the treatment is landing and how my prayers became simpler and simpler over the course of the year. And none of them ever were about status or how much I had accumulated. I never once was in that machine in the vulnerability of life and death thinking, bring me a new Mercedes. You know, it was poignant things like, may I live long enough to see my sister get married? You know, may I live long enough to help bury my parents? Like things that really touch the heart in its most significant way. And I think that called me in part, at least to know what to prioritize.
Right.
And then I had the enormous privilege of working for a decade in my 20s at the Cathedral Church of St. John the Divine, which at that time was a hotbed of ecumenicism and consciousness and social activism and liturgy. And I just got exposed to some of the most expansive teachers and practices of our generation. And it lit a big fire in me, very much so. Yeah.
It's such a evocative word when you say I was frail. I'm wondering how you rebuilt your strength.
Yeah, I mean, since you highlighted that word, let me say, I don't think anybody, or let me say it more personally, my physical frailty was a symptom of a much deeper emotional frailty. And so the answer to how did I regain strength, which I wouldn't say is something I did, but something I received as a grace, started physically. I had to rest a lot after the treatment. I went and moved near the ocean to be inspired by something larger than myself. I had a lot of tending from family and friends, lots of gestures of kindness and caring. But I think the deep inner work started with really a psychotherapeutic process that led me to a body work and somatic process. And those two together over 30 years, that's a long journey, over 30 years led me to feel like I have some strength again, you know, or strength anew maybe is more accurate. Yeah.
Right. And how do you name your strength now?
I don't think your strength. Make a distinction between strength and faith. I think I draw my strength from feeling God's presence in my life. And in life.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ways I know you is as the founder of, I want to make sure I get this right, Mobius Executive Leadership, you know, a firm that is doing this profound and complex work around leadership, not just that here are the 8 tips on leadership, you'll love number 7, it will change your life, but, you know, a much more complex, nuanced, multidimensional approach to leadership. One of the possible reactions to the experience you had early on with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma would be to conserve energy. But it strikes me that you have quite an ambition. I'm wondering what you're ambitious for.
I don't think my ambition has changed much since the last CAT scan, which is, you know, a lovely Christian prayer, you know, make of my life an instrument of thy peace. I hunger to feel like I'm making a difference and a contribution and to be one of the people who looks towards what's hurt and what's mute in society and not looks away. And I also think that's our role as leadership consultants is to be part of the call to leaders to dedicate their life to something that is of restoration, is of repair, and is of healing. A lot of leadership development work can be kind of a cookie cutter recipe. And maybe that helps with a sort of behavioral change process, but it won't help with the evolution of maturity and really helping somebody progress from being oriented to external benchmarks of success to being guided by their own inner ethical and sort of deeper soul purpose.
I mean, I'm hearing something pinging. I'm wondering whatever that is, if you could.
I was wondering that too. And I think it might be my WhatsApp and I canceled that and could be my messages. And I've now canceled that.
Technology so. Again.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Thank you. To live a life of service, how did you come across this commitment to leadership as being, of all the things you could do, the thing you're going to do?
in a way, a circuitous path. It sort of, I'll tell two stories. So in the late 80s, I had the privilege of working with Paul Gorman and then Senator Gore and the luminary scientist Carl Sagan and his wife Annie Druyan to try to jumpstart or catalyze an interfaith response to the environmental crisis and the environmental justice crisis. And it was very, very clear from being part of this coalition of religious leaders across every part of America's faith communities, the role of a moral voice in the public discourse around the issue of our generation. And it was, you know, our collective belief that we had to help the discussions on climate change move from being argued on economic terms to being argued on human terms and collective care for creation. So I learned a lot about the power leaders can have to move society forward in its understanding and its responsibility and responsiveness to collective dilemmas and challenges. So that's one piece. The second piece is that I had the real privilege through my sister's long-term lectureship at Harvard Law School to be part of teaching a body of work that came out of the research at the Program on Negotiation called Difficult Conversations, a book by my colleagues, Bruce Patton, Doug Stone, and Sheila Heen. And when we would teach that book, it was sort of a training for middle managers. And those middle managers would always learn some skills and then say at the end of the two-day program, yeah, but we don't see our senior leaders doing that. Or, yeah, we couldn't do that because it's not, you know, acknowledged or sanctioned in our corporate culture.
Right.
And I got very interested at that point in working with the people who shape the culture, not just are subject to the culture. And in some sense, everyone in a company can influence a culture.
That's right.
But of course, we role model and we get permission for, particularly for innovative cultural dynamics, come most easily into a system from the top.
I was hanging out with Doug Stone just last night, as it happens.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, it was. Then one of the things that you said right at the start was you help leaders come home to themselves. That feels like an unusual way of framing leadership. You know, so often people think of leadership as like not coming home to anything, but charging out over something, over the hill, the hordes behind you, waving the flag, blowing the trumpet. What is this journey to come home to yourself, and why is that leadership?
So I have a hypothesis that much of what's damaging and dysfunctional and unproductive in organizational life comes from untreated trauma and regressive psychological states that the leaders make their choices from or lead from. And those unconscious fears, beliefs, habits of power over, habits of aggression, power, habits of scarcity, habits of fear, have enormous influence on the cultural fabric of most organizations. So what I mean by come home to themselves is twofold. It's one, it's unlocking the unfelt experience that leaders walk with that keeps them numb and out of relation. And when you don't feel the people around you, you A, walk too much alone yourself as a leader, you get isolated, you don't get feedback, you don't see your blind spots, you don't mature over time, but you also don't make spontaneous offers of generosity and belonging and caring to the people that you lead. And an organization that's denuded of that kind of mutual compassion, mutual solidarity, mutual tenderness, is it an organization that can act in cruel ways to its employees, in extracting ways to its ecological environment, and in disrespectful ways to the community of commons in which it operates? So I don't know another way to help leaders into their full nobility or their full possibility than helping them systematically to unnumb their heart and also have a real understanding of why that numbness is there in the first place, because we're not born numb. We numb ourselves because different things happen in our lives that are too painful to integrate at the time that they happen.
This is going to be a perfect setup for the pages you're going to read for us. So Nice segueing on my behalf. I appreciate that. But before I get you to introduce your book and your pages, tell me what you mean by trauma, because it's one of those words that I see a lot and I think I know what it means and I'm not sure what it means. So how would you define or help articulate what trauma means in the way that we're talking about it now?
Yeah, well, as you correctly intuited, Michael, the pages do a good job of answering that question, but I'll just give you my quick gestalt answer before I read. One way to think about trauma, we often talk about traumatic events. What's traumatic for one person is not what's traumatic for another person. There's no objective standard or series of incidents that one could define as, quote, trauma. Trauma is the internal response to anything that in the moment feels to your psyche, to your emotions, and to your body too impossible to integrate and stay present to. It's the internal downregulation of sense experience and emotional experience in the heat of an impinging incident or situation that's overwhelming or overstimulating. That's trauma.
That is fabulous and very helpful to understand. So tell me about this book you've chosen to read.
I will, but I just want to say one more thing. I said in a speech that I made a year ago that there were two secrets in corporate life. And one of them I said was the degree of trauma that people are walking around with. So although I've said there's no defining set of activities that one could say constitute trauma, I would equally say I've met very, very few leaders who didn't have traumatic experiences in their life that for them were too overwhelming. Most of us, I'll go short of saying universally, but most of us have something that is keeping us from a full sense of embodiment, aliveness, relational attunement, and our highest potential.
I love the, you said highest potential, you also said full nobility, which I think is such a rich, generous, lovely phrase. I mean, I'd like to reach my full nobility. I don't know what that is, but I'd like to get
there. Yeah, but it's so beautiful what you said, Michael, because that's true for everyone.
Yeah.
One of the greatest hopes I carry from doing this kind of trauma work inside business is that all leaders that I invite into this journey are relieved to have a refuge place to look at their lives in a meaningful way, are grateful for the companionship of a skilled facilitator to do that, and are absolutely ready and eager to be lifted up to their highest possibility, yearning to be part of the solution of life.
I hear that.
Yeah.
The book.
Yeah. The book is a beautiful book from my teacher, Thomas Hubel, with whom I've had the enormous privilege of studying and collaborating for the last decade of my life. Thomas's work on healing family, ancestral, and collective trauma has enormously informed and refined who I am as a leadership practitioner. And this book, his latest book, is called Attuned, subtitled Practicing Interdependence to Heal Our Trauma and Our World. And in some ways, I would say if trauma is the ever-present barrier to our full possibilities, relational intimacy and love is the antidote. Mm. And that's what these pages speak to.
How did you first come across Thomas's work?
About 10 years ago, a friend of mine was studying with him and mentioned to me that there was a person who was a mystical teacher who was bringing the sort of universal mystical principles that are found in every faith tradition, every scripture, every path of awakening, and applying them to modern life with a particular eye on how to heal the long-held scars in the fabric of humanity. So Thomas at that time, as he still was doing a lot of work on post-World War II trauma and working with descendants of German Nazi soldiers and descendants of the Holocaust survivors. And I found that tremendously moving. When I first started listening to him and realizing that he's looking at the very hurts, the deepest hurts that society doesn't tend to except when they explode as repetitive patterns, as we're tragically seeing in the last 2 weeks in the Middle East.
Yes.
I think we can see now much more starkly than it was possible to see 10 years ago, how many of these deep wounds across different communities, across different faith communities, across different geographies urgently need to be addressed proactively in order for us to have the possibility of giving our, you know, future generations a planet of peace and a planet of harmony.
And before we get to the two pages, tell me what the word mystical means, because honestly, I have a slightly twitchy response to it, which is, okay, it sounds like there's too many crystals and kaftans involved in this. And I know you to be a very serious practitioner in this leadership work, who's not unlikely just to go, I've lit incense, my work here is done. So can you explain what you mean by mystical, please?
Sure. I mean, I think you could think of it on a continuum, but just to say it simply, Michael, it's the flame in the human heart that inspires us to goodness.
Okay, that's lovely. Yeah. Is it connected to religion or spirituality? Does it fit in that kind of on that spectrum somewhere, or is it sort of above and below that?
Yeah, I mean, the mystical principles I'm talking about would be applicable in any. As I said, they're just universal truths that are articulated or pointed at through religious scripture, through sacred text, through various practices. And one of the reasons I think that we have a resistance to the fact that the world is, enchanted in that way. There are blessings. There are, miracles. There is healing. Significant change can happen for people, even no matter what they've walked. One can restore oneself to really, there's like an inner chamber of the heart that's never been harmed, and one can find one's way back to that peace. I believe in all of that, but because religion has sometimes been practiced in ways that were damaging and abusive and traumatizing, many of us equate religious austerity or religious organizations with what I'm pointing out, which is really much more universal, the numinous quality of life. And you could look at nature and the absolute, order and coherence and intertwining of the natural world. The ecological world lives by these mystical principles. You don't have to look much further. You watch a family receiving a newborn baby and the natural outpouring of love and attunement and tenderness and holding that we would give. All of that is what I'm pointing at. Yeah,
that's perfect. Thank you. That sets that up really lovely, really nicely. And knowing that this book is important to you, how did you select the two pages to read for us?
I picked two pages that I thought both paint the severity of the nature of trauma in society and how it works and why it matters, but also have the seeds of the hope that I'm talking about.
What a wonderful setup. All right, Amy, over to you. I am excited to listen to you read.
Thank you. And thank you to Thomas for giving us this visionary understanding of this moment. Not all of the trauma that gets encoded in your central nervous system is yours alone. Some may be rooted in adversities that were experienced by an ancestor or many ancestors long before you were born. When a system of trauma is perpetrated for decades or even hundreds or thousands of years, its effects may be expressed by everyone born into that culture. In the history of our kind, countless traumas have been handed down from one generation to another in the form of unhealed, unintegrated energies, otherwise known as the crystallized past, which are now inextricable from our lives in the present. This is what traumatizing energies do. They fragment and separate our vital energy, making it difficult to be fully present in time while we are holding on to fractured past information. When something happens to activate a fragmented trauma, quote, file, so to speak, the nervous system becomes triggered or activated, and we find ourselves regressing back to the stage of our development at the time the trauma first occurred. For example, back into a five-year-old self. Knowing in advance what might activate a person's trauma is often hard to predict, and the response itself may seem outsized or irrational to an outside observer. This is due to the fragmented nature of trauma. Because the original energy of the trauma is broken apart in the system, any correspondences or links to the whole are themselves disconnected, making regression more likely. And this is not an accident. In fact, even the triggers or activations of past trauma possess a kind of evolutionary brilliance. When the five-year-old's trauma occurred, a certain aspect of their development was prevented from unfolding in a healthy way and is still waiting to be released. Still waiting to be released. Like a wrinkle in space-time, waiting to be smoothed so that the whole film can finally play clearly. The triggered regression is like a pop-up window, prompting that release. Warning, pay attention, look at this issue. These fragmented files explain why, in certain areas of your life, everything seems to flow in a synchronized manner, while in other areas, things can feel stuck or stagnated or blocked. Maybe in your professional life, things generally unfold easily. You tend to meet just the right people at the right time or attract key clients or customers with ease. Yet in your personal or romantic life, things might feel more difficult or less synchronized. That difficulty or stuckness may exist due to unintegrated traumas in the area of intimate relationships. There is either coherence and serendipity or incoherence, fragmentation, and desynchronization. In the event of the latter, there are signals one can look to in order to discover precisely which files are broken and in need of system cleanup. So often we struggle with fear, doubt, numbness, unease, and anxiety that overshadows the movie, which is to say, the fullest and clearest flow of light and information about our present experience, all that is happening and is available to us right now. Trauma energy creates a filter over our perception. Where we are traumatized, our perception of the world is distorted and limited. Awareness is reduced and overshadowed. That is why we so often project our disowned trauma onto the world and react as if the trauma is still happening to us because of other people. Genuine healing has the power to restore distortions and bring about inner and outer coherence, including improved relationships. As you heal, that broken piece belonging to your past can be brought back into the fold. Through embodied mature awareness, you become attuned to any parts of yourself that are absent or out of sync, and you can consciously work to reintegrate those aspects of self.
Amy, what is so important about what you've just read to us? What do we need to know?
And maybe I'll highlight just a few precepts in what Thomas wrote. I think the first is that the instinct to shut down and go numb and disconnect has an intrinsic life-affirming brilliance to it in that moment.
Yeah.
And if we want to be coaches or consultants or facilitators of healing, we have to be willing first and foremost to interpret things that people are doing now that appear dysfunctional or self-protective or occur out of that numbness and disembodiedness. We don't first judge it. We don't first assess it. We don't first make the meaning of it that it's a leadership weakness. Mm. We first have reverence for the fact that it's an early childhood survival strategy that's just past its due date.
Right.
It's antiquated. But its original intention and the energy that it's holding is self-protective and self-sustaining. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is to just normalize the fact that all of us have dimensions of our psyche that are contracted and self-protective in that way. It's universal. Yeah. That is truly universal. So that it should be something we can talk to each other about. In our programs, we ask people to look at what's their core underlying fear that causes their triggers and reactivity day to day in the workplace. Yeah. And so often, Michael, at the end of that discussion, leaders, very senior leaders, very successful people say, like, I thought I was the only one. You know, it's just such a relief to realize and be able to be vulnerable enough to admit we're all scared sometimes. You know, so
funny. I thought I was the only one. Turns out to be one of the great universal lies. You're never the only one.
That's
right. Trust me on this. You're never the only one.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Thomas has this wonderful teaching that, you know, in precision is love. And one part of what he means by that is being precise about who you're talking to and present to their unique beauty. But one part of what he means is the most nuanced in each person is also the most universal phenomenon.
Right.
Yeah.
Amy, I am really curious to know how one begins the journey, by one I mean me, back to discovering what the trauma is, because there's upside to numbness. Like, I don't have to look at it. I get to step away from it. I get to disassociate from it. If I want to heal, if I want to be less reactive, if I don't want to keep behaving in a way that was appropriate for a 5-year-old and is not appropriate for a 55-year-old, how do I start recognizing where the trauma is, how it's embodied, where might I find the scar?
I mean, you sort of answered your own question in a couple of ways, Michael. One is, I notice where I'm regressed. I notice where I can't bring my full fluid intellect, mind, heart, relational capacities, innovation capacities. Where do I get stuck? You know, in which context do I find myself knocked off balance? That's at least the sort of signposts of where the dilemma is. The second thing you said is, you know, respecting that there are contexts in which being numb is the right thing to do. I don't think there's an evolutionary pressure that everyone has to do this kind of trauma work unless they're responsible for a lot of people in a large organization. And then I think it's an ethical requirement to do enough healing work that you can be at least a benign agent in relationship, and ideally somebody who can be a walking alchemical response that helps others to feel safe, psychologically safe, included, cherished. Yeah. And, you know, you and I are both enormous fans of the coaching process, and I am equally confident that this can happen in well-facilitated group processes. But this kind of an unwinding process requires accompaniment. It requires witnessing. It's a kind of unfreezing process that has to be done and titrated to the pace that somebody can absorb. So working with somebody who's skilled in titrating the process, calibrating the process, making sure that it isn't a process that itself is re-traumatizing or overwhelming to somebody.
Right.
And, you know, making sure that it's a context in which not only are people trauma trained, but it's genuinely a gentle and caring place, that where you open your heart. You know, the unnumbing is a very tender and very important moment, and you want to pick and calibrate your setting very carefully, I think.
I love what you're saying around don't, you know, be accompanied, be witnessed around this. How and for the visiting of trauma, not to re-traumatize.
Yes.
I can imagine that being a danger. How do you help somebody be kind to themselves as they do this work? I just think of a few people I've been in conversation with lately, and my goodness, they're hard on themselves about the person they were and the person they are, and it's a little heartbreaking to hear their story of like literally adding insult to injury to injury to insult. I mean, this sad dance that happens. How do you help people hold a space of generosity and kindness for themselves on this journey?
Yeah, I mean, since so many of your audience are coaches or facilitators, I would start by saying we ourselves have to enter a space of self-forgiveness and self-blessing, or we're unlikely to be a field in which somebody can melt that habit of inner critic or inner judgment. Mm. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is understanding that many people for whom the trauma included absences of attunement, absences of affection, absences of celebration, very often they don't have core self-esteem. And a lot of the survival strategies that they employ are compensations for the absence of self-esteem. And so for them, part of the coaching work or part of the healing work is helping them to really understand their unique gifts, their unique strengths, their unique values, and how they express them in life. And that's part of the journey I referenced earlier when I said coming home. It's like, can I land in my own intrinsic goodness and sufficiency? And I think one of the things we have to help organizations to do is move from a performance management system that focuses largely on derailers and deficits to a performance management system that understands most people are walking with a self-esteem wound. And so if you manage performance by shaming people, that's not likely to be a very reliable path to inspiring them to their fullest creativity and their fullest abundance of contribution.
You know, when you put it like that, it seems fairly self-evident. Amy, you do this work, and the way we've talked about it at the moment has felt very much you working with individuals. But as you say, your work is actually to transform culture and organizations.
Very much so, yeah.
What conversations do you have with the powers that be to make them want to invest in this? Because there's a whole bunch of people I can imagine go, could we not just send them on a LinkedIn learning course? That would be cheaper and easier than this whole stuff. How do you make the case that this helps an organization, not just the individuals in the organization?
Yeah, there's a two-part answer to that question because you always ask these intricate ones. One, many of the things that organizations now consider cultural imperatives, the need to innovate, the need to adapt, the need to manage complexity, the need to have cross-matrix collaboration, the need to build trust, the need to increase inclusion and diversity. All of those organizational imperatives require an organization that operates as a living human system in kind and, you know, wholesome ways. I can't have diversity if I can't walk the pain you've lived. I can't have inclusion if I don't know how to listen. I can't have innovation if I don't feel safe enough to experiment, and I can't feel safe if my fear level is too high. So one part of it is just helping people to make the links between this kind of inner development and the organizational culture they aspire to create already.
Right. That's really helpful.
And I think the second thing that I find, at least when I'm talking to clients, is that they've had so many experiences of leadership development that's like a hallmark event. You know, it's sort of aphorisms and three tips, as you said. And we all know we're at the edge of the, you know, what that can do and where that can take you. And when you say to somebody in an unmitigated offer that has profundity and depth, something else is not only possible, it's urgently needed and it's wildly impactful. And you sing some of the music of what that looks like, people really telling their life stories to each other, people really learning to witness each other's path, people learning to create and tap into their intrinsic joy, people learning, you know, to bear witness, et cetera, many things you could say. The depth of that, the truth of that, the sort of intrinsic yearning we all have to be part of that intimate fabric, it just touches people's hearts. You know, it's not a hard sell, actually.
One of my a model I come back to, or a framework I come back to, is the Martin Buber I it versus I thou relationships. And you're very much talking about how do we build and sustain and invite people into I thou relationships.
Yeah, that's gorgeous. And I, you know, I think until we do that, we're going to see a world that just repeats the violence and degradation of one another over and over. And when we do that, we're back in the Garden of Eden.
You've answered some of this already, but I'd love to ask you explicitly, what do you feel we need to unlearn about leadership?
We need to get rid of the bifurcation of a leadership development path with the cultivation of spiritual, psychological, and spiritual intelligence. They can't be two separate things. The cost of that is too high. Too many people are walking around out of alignment with what they value, out of alignment with their family commitments, lonely and isolated from the people they work alongside every day, and in acting in ways that are not consistent with even the things they espouse.
One of the things that you talked about right at the start of the conversation was, you know, for leaders not just coming home to themselves, but caring about the world. And so much of what we've talked about at the moment already feels quite a lot. Heal trauma, come home to yourself, be fully spiritually developed, be the fullest, move towards your own ability, build either relationships with the people with whom you work. I'm like, that's going to take me at least till Friday to get all of that done. How do you help people not just do their own work and their own interrelational work with the people around them, but to also care about the world?
People do care about the world. I don't have to help them to do that. I just have to give them license to legitimize that care as part of the fabric of their life and to believe they could make a difference.
Right.
We naturally care about each other. We naturally care about the world we live in. We naturally care about the planet. It's only a traumatized society that doesn't take that as a premise. So that's number one. Number two, I really think each person has to figure out where their scope of concern can be. You know, for some people who are, you know, all they can do is make sure their kids are taken care of. And that's beautiful and an unbelievable contribution to the fabric of life. And for someone else, their wingspan can be, you know, to be a public official caring about legislature, and somebody else is a peace negotiator. I don't have a bias of anybody's wingspan. I have a bias that what they've, the hurts in their life, not interfere with their actualizing their intrinsic wingspan.
Amy, it's been a wonderful conversation, which surprises me not a single jot.
thank you so much.
I do have a last question for you, which is this. What needs to be said that hasn't yet been said in this conversation between you and me?
If you do this kind of work, you also have to tend to your self-care and make sure that you put the oxygen mask on yourself first. I think all of us in the helping business, in the healing business, are at risk of tending to ourselves last on the list. So maybe just a word of tenderness to remind everybody to take good care of themselves.
I thought the conversation with Amy about frailty was particularly poignant. When things are robust, you know, the opposite of frailty, when things are robust, you can push on, you can push on through. You pick up momentum, you use your weight, you use your heft, and you get over or you get through what's getting in the way. But frailness to me reminds me of translucence, a thinness between things on one side and things on the other, a physical quality that allows a different light to shine through. You'll find Amy and her colleagues at Mobius at mobiusleadership.com. Now, if you're interested in what's most interesting in leadership, I suggest you sign up for their occasional newsletter. And I would say that this, that they curate really extraordinary events with really marvelous teachers. You'll also find details of their socials at their website, and I'd say that they're particularly active on LinkedIn. Now, if you enjoyed my conversation with Amy, no doubt you did, then let me recommend two complimentary episodes. Number 152, What If You Were Living a False Life, with Hal Gregerson, reading To Know As We Are Known, and Let Your Life Speak, and A Hidden Wholeness. He did a kind of amalgam of work from Parker Palmer. Now, Hal is the master of the profound question. And this is truly one of my favorite conversations from the whole two pages collection. And then the other episode is number 122, The Doorway to Shared Meaning, with Haesun Moon. And she's reading On Dialogue by David Bohm. Now, Haesun's a wonderful author and a coach, also a fellow Torontonian. And this conversation was about the power of language to deepen understanding and unlock transformation. You can support this podcast by signing up for the Substack newsletter, joining as a paid member if you'd like the cool bonuses, recommending episodes you love to people you like, and of course, leaving a review if you're so moved. Doing one of those things is lovely, doing more than one is thoroughly delightful. And as I love to say, you're awesome and you're doing great.